Erica Soderstrom and Natalie White. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
KQED News, Morning Edition, the California Report, all ahead at 8. Let's find out what's ahead if you're headed to the South Bay now at 7:59.
Trouble on 85 northbound just before Blossom Hill Road. Two-car crash on the shoulder. Another one in the same direction around Saratoga Avenue. Nonetheless, that's caused a backup all the way to Blossom Hill Road. On the Dumbarton Bridge, it's slow from the Radio Towers to University Avenue. On the San Mateo Bridge, it's stop and go all the way, beginning at Hesperian Boulevard to 101 on the other side. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health, collaborating with Marin Health in the North Bay to deliver exceptional orthopedic care, including surgical and non-surgical options for spine conditions. UCSFHealth.org/Marin Health. Good morning. Thank you for listening. I'm Dave Freeman on member-supported KQED FM 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI FM 89.3 North Highlands, Sacramento. If you have a smart speaker, ask it to play KQED.
Good morning. Some Americans don't like their choices in the upcoming presidential election. We'll hear how these so-called double disapprovers in key swing states could decide who wins. It's coming this hour on Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, an Oakland A's pitcher is declared ineligible for a year for betting on baseball.
A radio show in Houston that started in the 70s was all about LGBTQ people. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Hear how hundreds of old cassette tapes of that show are now online for everyone to hear. Also, the story of how the FBI ran a smartphone company. The phones were specifically for criminals so they could spy on them. It's Tuesday, June 4th. Today in 2002, Avril Lavigne released her debut album, Let Go. It had two of her biggest hits, Complicated and Skater Boy. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland is condemning attacks on the Justice Department. He's currently testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. Garland says there are conspiracy theories circulating that the Justice Department worked with a local New York District Attorney to charge and convict former President Donald Trump. Garland rejected that, and he says false allegations like these are attacks on the judicial system.
I will not be intimidated. And the Justice Department will not be intimidated. We will continue to do our jobs free from political influence, and we will not back down from defending democracy.
Some Republican lawmakers also want to hold the U.S. Attorney General in contempt. That is because the Justice Department has refused to turn over audio recordings of President Biden's interview with a special counsel. The interview was about Biden's handling of classified documents. Biden was not charged. Opening statements are underway in the federal firearm trial of Hunter Biden. The president's son is accused of lying on a form to purchase a gun. He denies the charges. President Biden is expected to announce today a new executive order aimed at curbing the high number of asylum seekers at the southern U.S. border. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports Biden is likely to rely on a similar law used by the Trump administration.
The expectation is that Biden will invoke and rely on Section 212F of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which grants the president authority to block the entry of migrants he thinks are detrimental to the interests of the U.S. The provision would allow the president to suspend entries once the number of unauthorized crossings reaches a certain daily threshold. This section was used by President Trump in 2017 when he tried to ban immigration and travel from several majority Muslim countries. And just like during the Trump administration, Biden's proposal is likely to be challenged in court by immigrant rights groups. Sergio Martinez-Beltran, NPR News.
A federal appeals court is suspending a program that provides grants to black female entrepreneurs. NPR's Kristen Wright reports the court is blocking the program while the case plays out.
The federal judges found conservative activist Edward Blum is likely to prevail in his racial discrimination lawsuit against venture capital firm Fearless Fund, based in Atlanta. The suit cites a Reconstruction-era law. Blum was also behind the Supreme Court case that effectively ended race-conscious policies in college admissions. His American Alliance for Equal Rights says it's grateful for Monday's ruling. Fearless Fund's mission is to bridge the gap in venture capital funding for women of color. CEO and founder Arian Simone Simone says the judges sent a message that diversity in corporate America, education, or anywhere else should not exist. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
Stocks are lower on Wall Street. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. Major League Baseball is declaring a pitcher for the Oakland A's ineligible for 1 year for betting on baseball while he was in the minor leagues. The punishment against Michael Kelly is one of several MLB handed down to players after finding they placed bets with a legal sports book. The A's, in a statement to KQED, say they were disappointed to learn of the matter involving Kelly. The team notes Kelly's apparent gambling occurred before he joined the A's. Kelly joined the A's for this season. He's played in 28 games for the team, has a record of 3-2, and an earned run average of 2.59. A massive fire on Monday destroyed an affordable housing project that was under construction near Redwood City. KQED's Joseph Jiha reports.
The project is called Middlefield Junction, and it's been under construction for about a year. It was meant to provide nearly 180 units of affordable housing in the Pricey Peninsula. Fire officials say the wood frame building was destroyed, though the concrete foundation and underground parking areas may still be intact. Menlo Park Fire District Chief Mark Lorenzen says the fire was made worse by the windy conditions and the unfinished state of the building.
No sprinkler systems, no firewalls, so almost the worst stage it could be in from a fire's perspective because, you know, it burns so easily through there. It's just like kindling.
The 8-alarm fire began on the fifth floor around 10:15. The cause is under investigation. I'm Joseph Jiha, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more news at KQED.org.
Support for NPR this morning comes from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits. At Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And the listeners and members of KQED. Mel has traffic now in San Francisco at 8:06.
101 northbound between Candlestick Point and the hospital curve, that's stop and go. And then problems on 80 westbound just east of 9th Street. The two middle lanes are blocked by a three-car crash. Traffic stopped all the way through the city back to the center anchorage. Coming onto the Bay Bridge, the backup is to the maze. It is slow starting at the incline well past Treasure Island. Mel Baker for KQED.
And traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Brian returns with KQED News ahead at 8:22. Here's a name to remember, Kelsey Whitmore. She's the pitcher for the Oakland Ballers and the first woman to play in the Independent Pro Pioneer Baseball League. Learn more about Whitmore ahead at 8:22 on KQED Public Radio. Sunshine, warm to hot weather ahead in Northern California, just about everywhere it looks like. For the Sacramento Valley, the excessive heat warning starts at 11. Sunny, warm to hot. Highs will range today from 97 to 103. Some warm to hot gusty winds, maybe to around 30 miles per hour late afternoon. Clear tonight, low temperature 67 to 73. Hotter weather tomorrow, highs 100 to 106 possibly. For the Bay Area, warm to hot. The cool spot to be near the water today, mid-60s along the coast. Upper 90s are forecast well inland today. The heat advisory for the inland areas starts, in fact, it just started at 8 o'clock and will continue in effect until Thursday evening. It's 8:07.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Many Americans do not want to vote for either President Biden or former President Trump this year. You might even be one of them. Many people told pollsters they disliked their choices even before last week's verdict in a criminal trial for former President Trump. So, in recent weeks, we assembled a small group of such voters to hear what's on their minds. NPR's Mara Liasson and Susan Davis are in our studios. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to see you both. Mara, how many voters are dissatisfied with their choices?
A lot of them. About 14% of the electorate, according to NPR's polling partner Marist. Hmm. In the latest poll that Marist did for us, they split evenly between the two candidates. The same number of them are represented nationally as in the swing states. This isn't a new idea. Double haters were around in 2016. They broke for Trump. They were much smaller amount in 2020, about 3%. The question this year is, how do they split? Do they hold their noses and vote for Trump or hold their noses and vote for Biden? Or do they vote for a third party? Or maybe they just stay home. And it's possible that the real competition here is not the other candidates. It's the couch.
Okay, with that question in the air, Sue, how did you try to find out what's on these voters' minds?
So we asked focus group guru Rich Tal with the public opinion research firm Engages, along with Sago, a market research firm, to put together a couple of focus groups with proven swing voters who reside in swing states. Now, we just referred to these voters as double haters, but it might be more accurate to call them double disapprovers. A lot of them feel generally positive about Joe Biden as a person, less so about Donald Trump. They're just really disappointed that these are the options on the ballot. All 12 of the voices you're going to hear were Trump to Biden voters, and 10 of the 12 live in a swing state that helped decide the 2020 election.
What are things that you heard that I should be listening for now here?
Well, first of all, don't forget, this is anecdata. It's not a scientific poll with a giant sampling. It's 12 people. But
right.
My biggest takeaway was negative partisanship. How much that is the driver of this election. People are going into the voting booth to vote against someone to stop that person from getting into office, not necessarily because they love the guy they're voting for. And that is why, because both of these candidates are unpopular, they are going to be spending so much time and money trying to disqualify their opponent. Remember, Biden always says, compare me to the alternative, not to the almighty.
So what do you hear in this group, Sue?
Today, Biden appears to have an advantage with them. 7 of the 12 said if the election was today, they'd vote for him, but that drops to 5 voters when given third-party options. That suggests that is a much bigger electoral risk for the incumbent president. Steve, let's listen to a bit of what these voters had to say as Rich asked for their thoughts on the candidates.
So let's start with President Biden. I mean, for the first word or phrase that comes to mind when you hear President Biden. Sherilyn, what's yours?
Struggling.
Asa?
Concerned.
Okay. Rob?
Senile.
Bob?
Patriotic.
Nakia?
I would want to say senile too.
Eugene?
Old.
Next person. First thing that comes to mind. Former President Trump.
Jackass.
Unhinged.
Not an option.
Offensive, definitely.
Frightening. Uncensored.
Okay. So for a moment, let's imagine the election is tomorrow. By a show of fingers, if these were your only two choices, who would not vote? Asa, why would you not vote?
I find it hard to believe that in the entire nation of millions and millions of people, that we are right back to the line of two people. I don't understand how we end up with just two people.
So the four of you who would take Biden, Nakia, tell me why you would take Biden.
Well, he really didn't do much this time, but I would be willing to give him a second chance for a number of reasons. And at the top of my list, I definitely need my student loans wiped out.
Got it. Thank you. Bob?
I have much more confidence in Biden's ability to represent the country in foreign affairs. I think that from an integrity perspective, he is by far the better choice.
Rob, why would you take Trump?
The economy was better. Immigration was better controlled.
Got it. For all six of you, by a show of fingers, who wishes that neither Trump nor Biden were running this year? All six of you.
And in the second focus group, all six voters again said they wish neither man was running. Rich pushed them on issues like the economy, immigration, and abortion.
Who would say that the U.S. economy right now is in lousy shape? Wow, all six of you. So economists are telling us that our economy is thriving. It is surging. Kimberly, what do you see that they don't see?
They must not be going to the grocery store and have kids to feed. I just went yesterday with my son and the prices at the store are just unattainable.
Juanita?
The same thing. I live on a fixed income and just trying to go to the store to buy groceries or get my medication. It's impossible on what I make.
I'm going to change topics. By a show of fingers, who's concerned about the situation at America's southern border? All six of you. So I'd like to know, thinks that Trump would do a better job handling the situation at the border? Four of you. Juanita, why did you say Trump would do a better job?
At least he was trying to do something. It doesn't seem like Biden's trying to do anything at all.
Jenna?
I don't necessarily like his tactics, but at least, like I said, he was trying to do something.
Okay. Jennifer?
I would agree with that. He was making some kind of effort, although it was very controversial. I'm going to put up a wall. He was having some kind of success, or at least making some effort to make a change.
By a show of fingers, for how many of you will abortion be a big factor in who you'll vote for in November's presidential election? 4 of you will be a big factor. Alicia, how's it going to be a big factor for you?
Because I don't think states should decide that. I think it should be up to the woman.
Okay. So help me with this. You said you were going to vote for Trump if it's a two-way race. Trump wants to give it back to the states. How does that fit into your calculus?
Well, I would say look at all of what he supports versus, so I guess it wouldn't necessarily make me not vote for him if he, you know, there's bigger factors that I look at in that situation.
Okay. So it matters, but other things matter more.
Yeah.
Okay. If each of you had to place a $50 bet on the outcome of this election, show of fingers, who thinks that Trump is going to win this election? 5 of you. Brian, you put your money on Biden? Okay.
Great stuff. 2 focus groups presented to us by NPR's Mara Liasson and Sue Davis. They were conducted by Rich Tao, who ran them for NPR News, and he's on the line. Welcome.
Great to be here.
How do these people we just heard compare with people in many, many other focus groups you've conducted?
Well, we've been doing these focus groups each month with Trump to Biden voters, people who are basically your double haters, double disapprovers, and they sound very similar. There's a consistency month over month that we hear that's truly remarkable.
Some people who dislike these voters may think of them as low information voters. Do you see them that way?
I would say that they are generally not paying close attention to what's going on day to day politically.
Okay. Where are they getting their news?
They get them from all over the place. They get it from major news outlets. They get it from local news outlets. They get it from social media. There's a huge splinterization that drives the lack of cohesion in how they view the world collectively as a group.
Okay, when you think about all these voters you've listened to, and then you pull out and you read the news and you hear what the presidential candidates are saying, how do their appeals compare to the people they're appealing to?
Well, that's the huge gulf that we heard. For example, we heard that only 1 of 12 of these voters in these focus groups knew what President Biden has planned for the next 4 years if he gets reelected. So clearly, some of the messages that are coming from the campaigns are not getting through to these voters.
How appealing are third-party candidates such as RFK Jr. to these people?
They're appealing largely because they're not Trump or Biden. These folks are so desperate for a third-party alternative that they're willing to seriously consider candidates that they know very little about.
I want to pull out from the candidates specifically. Clearly, they're disappointed with the presidential nominees of the major parties, but how do they feel about the direction of the country?
They're very down on the direction of the country, mainly because they're down on the economy. Most of these voters, when talking to them, when they describe the economy, it's as though we're in May of 1932 as opposed to May of 2024. They think the economy is in horrible shape, inflation is ravaging their lives, and they can barely make ends meet.
I want to take seriously what people are saying, because everybody is paying higher prices than they were a few years ago. That feels real. But is there another level of this where people are in some way being deceived?
Well, if they're being deceived, they don't seem to realize that they're being deceived. They seem to take it as axiomatic that they're paying more for groceries now and more for gasoline than they were when Biden took office, and they can't afford it, and they're complaining about it.
It's normal that the president of the United States, the incumbent, whoever it is, would face the responsibility for people feeling that way. Isn't that right?
Generally, it is. I mean, they understand that the pandemic had a huge impact on prices, but for them, it's the overall sense that things are spinning out of control, not just in terms of the economy, but in terms of world events, wars overseas. And a lot of that basically falls on Biden's doorstep, combined with their sense that Biden isn't up to the job.
I want to ask about one other thing. We heard one person there say that her view on abortion was clearly not Donald Trump's view on abortion, but that she was likely to vote for Trump because she takes a complicated view of multiple issues and she's thinking about other things. Do you find that most people do wrestle with and ultimately make a fairly sophisticated choice about who to vote for?
I think a lot of people do wrestle with issues. The fact of the matter is, though, a lot of this is driven by personalities, and they've had a chance to see Trump as president and Biden as president, and they're rendering an opinion based upon what they've seen. And for a lot of them, they're so disappointed with those two choices that they're wrestling with either not voting or voting for a third-party candidate. And that's the biggest challenge that the two major party candidates are facing in this election.
Okay, Rich Tao, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Rich Tao of Engages Research, which partnered with NPR News to conduct focus groups, and we're going back to these same voters just before Election Day to find out where they land. This is NPR News.
Here on KQED Public Radio, we are going back to the Bay Area traffic desk and find out about traffic in Santa Rosa with Mel.
Where we have a sig alert. This is 101 southbound before Todd Road. The left lane blocked by a two-vehicle crash. Traffic is stopped back to 3rd Street. No word on when they'll clear it. 101 northbound between Santa Rosa Avenue and Steel Lane. That's stop and go. And further south on 101 southbound between Roland Boulevard and North San Pedro Road. Be prepared for stop and go traffic. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. And support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, presenting the all-electric Kia EV6 with AR windshield head-up display and capable of going 0 to 60 in 4.6 seconds. More info at kia.com. On KQED, Brian Watt standing by with KQED News. It's coming up at 8:22. We hope you'll join us for Forum. That's at the top of the hour.
I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, if you work for the government or are an elected official, dealing with threats, intimidation, and stalking may be a new unofficial part of your job description. And the relentless, often anonymous harassment is affecting who's willing to run for office or stay there. We'll talk to experts about why violence is so prevalent against elected officials and what can be done to mitigate the threats. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
And at 10 on Forum, Forum considers the volatile politics of public education in California. Recent years have seen Republicans making inroads on local school boards. But now, some of those conservative officials are facing recalls. That's at 10 on KQED, Forum 9 to 11 today. Support for NPR comes from Lindemood Bell Learning Centers, summer instruction for students to catch up or get ahead, live online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindemoodBell.com/NPR. Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And TimberTech, sustainable decking materials with no staining or resurfacing needed, a range of products including furniture, porch boards, outdoor lighting, and accessories. More at TimberTech.com. And by the listeners and members of KQED Public Radio. Bay Area heat advisory in effect now until Thursday evening. Today's highs, mid-60s to the upper 90s inland. Sacramento, the valley, warmer today, warm to hot with highs 97 to 103. It's 8:22.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. Alameda County's Board of Supervisors is scheduled to consider two competing proposals today for oversight of the Sheriff's Department. In the last decade, numerous deaths at the hands of deputies on the street and inside the Santa Rita jail have resulted in the county paying out millions of dollars in settlements. KQED criminal justice reporter Julie Small joins me now to talk about what greater transparency and accountability might look like in Alameda County. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Brian.
So what changes are supervisors considering and why?
Well, currently the Board of Supervisors controls the sheriff's budget and can approve or disapprove budget proposals, but it doesn't really have any authority or control over the sheriff's conduct or department policies. So the proposals that may be discussed at today's meeting would create a 7-person citizens oversight board and an office of inspector general. Both are meant to investigate the sheriff's office. And both proposals provide an essential tool for doing that, the power to subpoena records and witnesses. The sheriff or representative is allowed to attend all the board's meetings, but would not have voting power.
Now, we have said these proposals are competing, which has to mean there are some key differences. Can you explain more about that?
Yes. One of the proposals being considered relies on Alameda's existing county council. But advocates for civilian oversight say that creates a conflict of interest because the county council's fundamental role is to protect the county from litigation, which would include protecting the sheriff's office. But advocates say there's a major flaw in both proposals that says the sheriff has the power to approve or reject investigations into staff misconduct. I reached out to Jerry Threets. He's an attorney who created the Sheriff Oversight Board in Sonoma County after that fatal 2013 shooting of the 13-year-old boy. Threets said giving the sheriff veto power over an investigation would be a huge mistake.
If you have to wait until the sheriff gives you permission to look at something, you have no independence. And if you don't have that, you don't really have a system that can provide effective oversight.
Advocates, including the ACLU of Northern California, which has been very involved in this process, say that provision, it needs to change to provide truly independent investigations into misconduct.
So how is the Alameda County Sheriff responding to this plan to increase oversight?
Well, I did get a response from the public information officer for the Alameda County Sheriff's Office. He wrote in an email that sheriffs have different legal authority than police. And quote, it is important to recognize that any oversight has to be conducted collaboratively with the interests of public safety, individuals' constitutional rights, and the county's fiduciary responsibility as the agenda. I think that's a polite response.
So what happens next?
If the supervisors read through the proposals today, they could vote on them or push the vote over to another meeting. But I get the sense that there's a lot of negotiating still going on as to whether the sheriff could prevent or delay investigations the way both proposals are currently worded.
KQED criminal justice reporter Julie Small, thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
The Oakland Ballers played their first 12 games of their existence on the road and won 7 of them. Their home debut is tonight in front of a sold-out crowd. Among the players suiting up for the Bees is a boundary-breaking pitcher, Kelsey Whitmore. KQED culture reporter Ariana Prale has her story.
Now pitching for Oakland, number 9, Kelsey Whitmore.
Taking the mound for the Oakland Ballers the other week against Montana's Glacier Range Riders, Kelsey Whitmore became the first woman to play in the independent pro Pioneer League. She's a right-handed pitcher and says her first outing didn't go as well as she wanted, but she pulled herself together for the next one.
And that's the name of the game. It's just kind of, there'll be ups and downs with it, and it's just like how well you can stay to maintain yourself with your mindset.
Baseball is her life. She's 25, and she's been playing the sport since she was a kid. In 2016, she started her pro career with the Sonoma Stompers, and 6 years later, she became the first woman to sign with a team in the prestigious Atlantic League. She also plays for the Women's USA baseball team, which will compete for a World Cup in August.
You know, when you have something in your heart that just feels right, and you just can't see yourself not doing, like, that's how baseball always felt to me.
Whitmore's desire to compete at a professional level is what stands out most to Ballers manager Micah Franklin.
I mean, it's a big step stepping into this realm, and it is very intimidating, and she is not intimidated at all.
Whitmore says she's had to train her mind over the years to handle being a woman in baseball, where she's faced plenty of negativity from naysayers.
At first, I let it eat me up. But then I switched it because I was so tired of letting it affect me. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to use it as like fuel to my fire.
Organizations like the Ballers can be more supportive, says Justine Siegel, founder of Baseball for All, a national nonprofit building gender equity in baseball.
I think that minor league baseball is more open to women playing, at least at the independent level.
Siegel, who was the first woman to coach pro baseball as part of the Oakland A's staff in 2015, says that the battle for opportunities to play starts early. From ages 7 and 8, girls get told they need to switch from baseball to softball to pursue a softball scholarship. Whitmore herself got funneled into softball in college. Siegel says that the Ballers being one of the hottest new teams and signing Whitmore sends a great signal.
It shows that they take players who can compete, and that's what women want.
While the surge in support for pro women's sports like soccer, basketball, and hockey has yet to hit baseball, Siegel does notice a shift happening, seeing the growth of her own programs. Whitmore is noticing the shift in attitudes, too. She says people used to attempt to correct her more often when she'd say she plays baseball.
He'll go, you mean softball, like every time. And I've noticed over the years, it's like now when I say it, they're like, oh, cool, what position do you play?
And if the next question is where she wants to take her baseball career, Whitmore has a clear answer.
I'm trying to get to the big leagues. I'm trying to get as far as I can. That's been the dream.
In the short term, though, her goal is to help the Bees get a championship ring this year for the Oakland fans that she says are more energized than any other fan base she's experienced. I'm Ariana Prale, KQED News.
The Oakland Bees take on the YOLO High Wheelers at Raimondi Park in West Oakland at 6:30 p.m. I'm Brian Watt. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
And we're staying in Oakland. Let's find out about traffic with Melna.
A number of problems. 880 northbound just south of Broadway. The right lane is blocked. Traffic is stopped back to Jackson Street by a four-car crash there. A three-car crash in 24 westbound east of Telegraph has the two left lanes blocked. Traffic in that location is stopped back to College Avenue. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Save the Bay. Imagining a Bay Area where people and wildlife thrive, the future is possible. Turn the tide and rise to the climate challenge. More at SaveSFBayNow.org. Hot climate today, 60s, upper 90s, Bay Area heat advisory in effect until Thursday. Even hotter, Sacramento, valley highs 97 to 103, 100 to 106, possibly tomorrow. It's 8:30.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden's expected to issue an executive order on the southern U.S. border. Immigration's a prominent election year issue. Many Republicans allied with Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, walked away from a comprehensive bipartisan Senate bill earlier this year. The White House had said the president would then consider taking executive action. And as NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports, that's what's being announced today.
The Biden administration has been piecemealing restrictions for the last few weeks. For example, he recently announced a new rule intended to speed up the removal of some migrants who are not eligible for asylum. And what Biden is expected to announce today would also limit asylum claims.
The president's son, Hunter, is back in a Delaware courtroom today. Opening statements are underway. His trial on gun charges began just days after former President Donald Trump's criminal trial for hush money payments ended in New York with his conviction. Nebraska authorities are investigating how a 74-year-old hospice patient ended up on an embalming table while she was still alive. Authorities say the woman was declared dead by her nursing home. Shocked funeral home workers realize the woman was still alive and rushed her to a Lincoln hospital. She died hours later. U.S. stocks are trading lower this hour. The Dow is down 39, S&P's off 18, NASDAQ's down 60 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. San Francisco city officials are backing a state bill that would give law enforcement more power to crack down on the sale of stolen goods on city streets. SB 925 would allow police to cite vendors who were found selling commonly stolen goods without permits. William Ortiz Cardaena, founder and treasurer of the community organization CLEJA, says the proposed legislation would help protect legitimate street vendors.
We're community and we don't get down with fencing, but we will always support our culture, our history of street vending, and our community and our entrepreneurs that make San Francisco so dope.
The bill is sponsored by Mayor London Breed and Senator Scott Wiener, who say they're working with several groups representing street vendors. Berkeley residents will vote on a new tax on large buildings that use natural gas in November. KQED science editor Kevin Stark reports.
Environmentalists gathered signatures for the ballot measure after Berkeley's ban on natural gas in new construction was blocked by a lawsuit from the California Restaurant Association. It's an attempt to encourage swapping gas appliances for electric ones to help combat human-caused climate change. Property owners would pay based on how much gas they use annually. Organizer Daniel Tahara says the tax money would be used to help electrify city buildings.
But there just isn't money for that anywhere. So that, you know, affects all the homeowners who want to electrify. And it affects also the renters who don't really have a choice in what types of appliances they have in their house.
The tax would require a simple majority to pass. I'm Kevin Stark, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more news at KQED.org.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco SPCA, where adoption fees are waived on animals 5 months and older through June. Listeners can find a furry new friend at the Adoption Center at 250 Florida or sfspca.org. Coming up on Morning Edition, chants calling for Intifada have been a prominent feature of pro-Palestinian protests. It's a charge word whose use is perceived differently by people with opposing views of the war in Gaza. One of the stories ahead, and California stories also ahead at 8:51 a.m. on your California Report. Support for NPR comes from Uma, cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local or global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. After six marathon weeks of voting across India, where nearly 1 billion people were eligible to vote, to cast a ballot or press buttons on an electronic voting machine, counting is now underway to tally the results.
And initial results suggest that the Prime Minister Narendra Modi of the BJP party will become Prime Minister for the third time.
On the line with us now to tell us more is NPR's Dia Hadid. She's in the capital, New Delhi. Hello, Dia.
Hi, Michelle.
How are the numbers looking so far?
Well, so far, a tally by India's Election Commission indicates that Modi's party, it's called the BJP, has won the largest number of seats in Parliament. It hasn't won a clear majority, but with its allies, it looks like it will be able to form a coalition government. On the flip side, India's opposition alliance has done better than exit polls expected, but it hasn't won enough seats to form government, according to the count so far.
So essentially, it's a victory for the BJP and a victory for the Prime Minister, yet again.
Yes, but you know, I'm on the ground in the capital, New Delhi, and if you were here just judging by the mood outside each of the campaign headquarters, you would say that Modi's BJP had lost and the opposition won. And that's because at the outset of these elections, Modi promised that his party would win a super majority. The exit polls predicted Modi's party would nearly hit those numbers. And so outside the BJP headquarters, we saw a man seemingly pray to a Modi-like god, beseeching him to come back to power. And so unless there's a dramatic change as counting continues, yes, Modi will return to power. He will be the only prime minister after the founder of modern India, Jawaharlal Nehru, to win three times. But he'll rule as a part of a coalition, not as this seemingly unstoppable juggernaut led by a man who recently suggested to a journalist that he was chosen by God.
So, dear, what does this mean for India going forward?
Well, Michelle, I think it will be harder for Modi and his party to continue their vast recasting of India as a country that elevates its Hindu majority above other citizens. Harder, but not impossible. It also appears to have signaled to the opposition, which is led by the Congress Party, that power is within reach. That party is led by Rahul Gandhi, the great-grandson of India's first prime minister. It used to dominate Indian politics, but it's waned in recent years. And under Rahul's leadership, the party shrank and shrank. But in these elections, the party looks like it won double the seats that it did in the previous ones. So now Rahul can show voters that he and the Congress Party can fight back. There'll be a more muscular opposition. And critics say that will also likely shake Indian institutions, which critics say were increasingly partial to Modi and his party in recent years, like the mainstream media, YouTube news outlets, influencers, law enforcement agencies, and even India's Election Commission itself.
That is NPR's Dia Hadid in New Delhi. Dia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
There's a chant that's become common at pro-Palestinian demonstrations across the U.S. It calls for Intifada. That's an Arabic word. It's also a point of tension when it comes to how people talk about the war in Gaza. NPR's Adrian Florido has this report.
This was the chant at a pro-Palestinian protest at Columbia University in New York in early May.
Intifada! Intifada! Intifada!
Intifada!
Intifada!
Intifada!
Intifada means uprising in Arabic. The two Columbia students I spoke with exemplified how, for people with opposing views on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the same word can mean vastly different things.
For me, it just speaks to liberation.
Basil Rodriguez, who was at that protest, is Palestinian-American.
To free Palestine from the apartheid regime and the military occupation. So to me, it calls for freedom and for change.
It's a call for resistance to Israel, Rodriguez says, but not for violence. Palestinians first started using Intifada in the 1980s during a period of protests and civil unrest against Israeli control that came to be known as the First Intifada. But for Eliana Golden, every time she heard it growing up,
the word Intifada was only associated with death and terrorism and destruction.
She's a Jewish American. For her, the word evokes the Second Intifada, a violent period in the early 2000s when Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups killed more than 1,000 Israelis, including through suicide bombings in restaurants, buses, and shops.
So Intifada still feels just as charged as if someone were to say Holocaust, or if someone were to mention any sort of catastrophe that happened against a people you consider yourself a part of.
She hears the Intifada chants as anti-Semitic, an open call for violence against Jews and Israelis. Taufik Ben-Amor is a linguist and professor of Arabic studies at Columbia. He says one reason the word's use in chants is so contested is because the protesters are choosing not to translate it from the Arabic.
If you turned the word Intifada into uprise, then it would belong to the English vocabulary, you know, that people are completely familiar with.
At many recent pro-Palestinian protests, it's not just the word Intifada, but entire chants that have been shouted in Arabic.
By not translating them into English, you can actually define their meaning as you want, you know, and so they become political weapons, so to speak. Sort of a weapon in both hands to be used in this political jostling that's happening.
Intifada's meaning, uprising, comes from the Arabic root meaning to shake off, as if dust from a cloth. And Ben-Amor says it's a common Arabic word for any kind of uprising. But he says Arabic words are often stigmatized, associated with violence and terrorism. As far as Intifada, the torturous history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has made it a loaded word. But for whom, he asks?
You know, the Palestinians who were killed during the Second Intifada, for example, have families too.
Three times as many Palestinians were killed as Israelis, yet Palestinians still use the word. Eliana Golden says she would like to believe her protesting classmates aren't advocating violence against Israel and Jews, but she can't ignore the context. They're not just chanting Intifada, she says.
They chant, we don't want two states, we want all of it. They chant death to the Zionist state. When there's so much other rhetoric going on within the same chants that obviously point to the destruction of Jewish people, why am I to believe that Intifada doesn't mean what I think it already means?
Basil Rodriguez says they refuse to sanitize their language because it makes a non-Arabic speaker uncomfortable.
It's our indigenous language as Palestinians. And so the idea that we have to not say a word because it's in Arabic, I think just plays into the racist assumption that Arabs are terrorists. And so I'm not going to ever stop saying the word Intifada.
The debate over the war in Gaza has made clear the power of language. Terms like Intifada, genocide, martyr, resistance, they're all fought over in the battle to shape public opinion of the war. Taufik Ben-Amor says this is nothing new in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's always been true and will be for a long time. Adrian Florido, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to KQED Public Radio. Now let's listen to Mel with San Jose traffic.
280 northbound before Ray Street, the two left lanes blocked by a three-car crash. Stop and go back to the 680-101 interchange. 880 southbound just north of Stevenson Boulevard, a center lane blocked by a stall in San Leandro. The two left lanes blocked on 880 northbound just south of 238. Traffic stopped back to Lewelling. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction. I'm Dave Freeman with a perspective now at 843. When you open your mail to find jury summons, what's your reaction? Listener Antonio Inserni gives us reason to see it as an opportunity.
The first time I was called for jury duty, it didn't work out so well. I knew I could do better. So the second time I was called, I was excited to participate. I wasn't the only one. After preliminary arguments, we were released for the day, and a fellow jurist and I went to lunch. As a new immigrant to this country, he talked incessantly about how great this system was and how, in his old country, nothing like this would have been possible. Imagine my disappointment. Imagine his disappointment when the court called to say that the case was settled out of court. Over the course of the phone call, the officer told me that I must be relieved not to have to do this. She expounded on how, now that it was settled out of court, I wouldn't have to think of some excuse to get out of it. Now, I wouldn't have to miss any pay, that I could get on with my plans. There would be no interruptions in my life. The overwhelming impression I got from her was of a person who had been harassed, someone constantly cajoled, someone battered by excuses and exceptions. I felt I was listening to someone who had started all this work with the highest of ideals, with the greatest of intentions, but now was so beaten down she'd had enough. She was throwing in the towel. She had called me at work, and I didn't want my coworkers to hear me tell someone that it wouldn't hurt me at all to be gone for a few days, or weeks, or months. But now I wish I had. I didn't do it then, but I'm doing it now. Dear jury gatherer person, most of us out here love you. Most of us really do want a jury of our peers, and that means we're willing to make some personal sacrifices to serve on a jury. Please take heart, because you are every bit as important to our legal system as any prosecutor, defense attorney, or judge. Without you, there is no court to go to. With a perspective, I'm Antonio Inserni.
Antonio Inserni is an artist living in the East Bay. Would you like to share your own perspective with our listeners? We'd like to hear from you. Check out our submission guidelines and then submit yours at kqed.org/perspectives. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and providing financial donations to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com. Morning Edition will continue. Coming up, Montana's Republican governor is being challenged from the right this primary election day. His opponent says the incumbent, who once body slammed a reporter, isn't conservative enough. That's coming up for you. And then here, California, the California Report with Marty Bolaños reporting from San Francisco, statewide coverage at 8:51 a.m. And then join us for Forum starting at 9 to 11 today. Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. The Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. And the listeners and members of KQED.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Montana's primary election is today. While Republican Governor Greg Gianforte is favored to win again, his conservative credentials are being challenged in ways that highlight tensions within his party. Here's Montana Public Radio's Shaylee Raker.
When then-President Donald Trump visited Montana in 2018, he called then-Congressman Greg Gianforte his kind of guy.
Any guy that can do a body slam, he's my kind.
He's referring to how Gianforte tackled a journalist the night before he was elected to Congress the year before. Gianforte eventually pleaded guilty to misdemeanor assault. And then he was elected governor in 2020 by double digits. Gianforte is a multimillionaire who made his fortune as a tech entrepreneur. He's also a devout Christian who's donated to religious private schools and a creationist museum. Democrats accuse him of being an extremist. His likely challenger in November, Ryan Bussey, criticizes Gianforte for signing tax cuts that disproportionately benefit the wealthy, anti-abortion policies, and vouchers for private school families.
I think it's something that's being done by a small cadre of radicalized Republicans and by this governor.
But some Republicans say Gianforte isn't conservative enough. State Representative Tanner Smith is challenging him in this year's primary election. Smith pointed to Gianforte's proposal to invest in affordable housing projects.
This guy is not a Republican, because those are not Republican principles.
Gianforte's faced criticism from the right wing of his party for allowing property taxes to rise and for backing Medicaid expansion. It's not the only race this fall that will show where the state stands. Three-term Democratic Senator John Tester will likely face a stiff Republican challenge. But Gianforte's primary highlights a split inside the GOP. He's built a power base with some more moderate Republicans, part of what they call the Solutions Caucus. Meanwhile, some of the party's more right-wing members, including the House Speaker, don't get Gianforte's endorsement. Here's Gianforte.
We looked at voting records. We looked at collaborative efforts with us. And I endorsed people that were good partners.
Republicans have surged in popularity in Montana in recent years. Before Gianforte won in 2020, Democrats held Montana's governorship for nearly two decades. Now, whoever comes out of the Republican primary will be favored against Bussey this fall. For NPR News, I'm Shaylee Reiger in Helena.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, you might think of couples therapy as a last-ditch effort to save a relationship, but a documentary series is challenging that idea. The show, called Couples Therapy, is following the experiences of couples in therapy at different stages of relationships. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. And to get the daily news and analysis you need to start your day delivered right to your inbox, sign up to the Up First newsletter. Today, we look at the FDA's review of the drug MDMA, commonly known as ecstasy. The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing data from a clinical trial that shows how the drug could be used to treat people with post-traumatic stress disorder. The Up First newsletter highlights the top three stories to keep you informed every day. But we also try to bring you some joy, too. So sign up at npr.org/upfirstnewsletter. This is NPR News.
And it's your California Report in just a minute, after traffic in Vacaville.
The Allison Avenue, Allison Drive off-ramp from eastbound 80 is partially blocked by a damaged attenuator barrels. It's remaining a SIG alert. In Santa Rosa, another SIG alert. This is 101 southbound before Todd Road. The left lane is blocked. Traffic is stopped back to Mendocino Avenue by a two-vehicle crash. 101 northbound between Golf Course Drive and College Avenue is stop and go from Rohnert Park. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Style Bath & Kitchen, providing design knowledge on how to pick the right kitchen faucet, cabinets, bathroom, shower, or bathtub, and more in their new video series, available on their website by searching Style Bath & Kitchen online. And UC Santa Cruz, where researchers discovered how often sea otters, a threatened species, use tools when feeding to survive in a rapidly changing environment. More at ucse.edu. The time now is 8:51.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Madi Bolaños in San Francisco, and here's some of the state stories we're following. Our first heat wave of the year is here. Californians can expect scorching temperatures inland from Palmdale all the way up to Redding. UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain says areas like Reno, Tahoe, and Shasta will see record levels for this time of year. And the National Weather Service in Sacramento has issued an excessive heat watch for the valley today through Thursday. Experts advise people to stay indoors and hydrated throughout the next few days. CAL FIRE is still investigating the cause of a major wildfire this weekend that started at a site maintained by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. KQED's Dan Brecky reports.
The Alameda County Fire Department was the first to respond to the Corral Fire Saturday afternoon. A fire dispatcher advised arriving crews that active power lines were down in the area. CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Josh Silvera says that's one of many possible causes that investigators will look at.
We're going to rule out power lines down. We're going to rule out wind causing power lines to slap, vehicle exhaust, trailer chains dragging and creating a spark. The investigation team is going to do everything in their power to figure out what truly caused this.
The 14,000-acre fire burned one home and closed a 15-mile stretch of Interstate 580 for a full day.
That was KQED's Dan Brecky.
Support for the California Report comes from the California Healthcare Foundation, Listening to Black Californians, a new study on how the healthcare system undermines the pursuit of good health, on the web at chcf.org/LBCA. Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and adult and children's health systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives, stanfordmedicine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery, on the web at schmidtocean.org.
Information about California legislators' property holdings will stay publicly accessible for now. That's thanks to an amendment to a bill that would have allowed lawmakers to shield more of their personal information on their annual financial disclosures. CalMatters' Alexi Kosev has more.
Every year, elected officials have to fill out a form that discloses to the public their financial interests, including property. Because of security concerns, lawmakers can shield certain private information, including their personal address and telephone number. This bill originally would have let them hide the address of rental properties and businesses they own as well. But with the amendment, that information will remain public. Transparency advocates say this is important because it allows Californians to see how the business interests of lawmakers may sway their votes, such as lawmakers who are landlords voting on renter policy.
That was CalMatters' Alexi Kosev. With two-thirds of California's unhoused population living unsheltered, cities are increasingly turning to tiny homes to get people off the streets quickly. Now, lawmakers are considering a plan to make it easier to build them. KQED's Vanessa Rancaño reports on how they're working for one city.
When 48-year-old Carlos Ruben Jacobo was living on the streets, he preferred to sleep in parks than take a bed at one of San Jose's group shelters.
There was just too many like horror stories for me to go there. Staff robbing you and people just robbing you, like just bad people there.
So when a caseworker offered him a spot at one of the city's newest tiny home villages, he was skeptical. He changed his mind when he learned he'd get his own room with a bathroom and air conditioning.
Then once I got in here, I was like, oh, I know everybody. Everybody's cool. Everybody's nice. And I feel safe here.
Jacobo is one of more than 1,600 people who've lived in a tiny home in San Jose. The city has embraced this type of temporary housing more aggressively than almost any other in the state. But leaders across California are turning to it as a faster, cheaper, and more humane way to whisk people off the streets. Now lawmakers are considering a plan that would clear some of the red tape that slows new projects down. State Senator Josh Becker introduced the legislation.
We've seen this dramatic increase in people dying on our streets. It's a crisis. So we need a holistic solution. This is part of the solution. We can get people off the streets much faster and in much larger numbers.
But not everybody's sold.
If half of American renters can't pay their rent, is a tiny home the answer for every single family, elder, or human being that needs a place to go?
Destination Home CEO Jennifer Loving argues they do nothing to prevent homelessness or solve it.
It's better than somebody being on the streets, but it's not an answer to homelessness.
Jacobo has now been living in his tiny home for a year. His room is one of 96 at the Guadalupe Interim Housing Site. It's small, but well-equipped.
So you got a mini fridge, you got twin size bed.
And a bathroom and a sink. I like everything about it. It's my own room. I wish I would have cleaned it though.
Jacobo plans to enroll in a job training program. He wants to work as a security guard.
I'm nervous because it's a new, it's like a new journey, but I'm excited at the same time because I want independence.
And he's working with his case manager to apply for housing. But he faces stiff odds. Just 30% of residents who've left this facility moved into permanent housing. Almost 40% returned to homelessness.
The biggest challenge that we're seeing in the data is on the permanent housing side.
Ryan Finnegan is a researcher with the UC Berkeley Turner Center for Housing Innovation. He says whether tiny homes really help people depends in part on what kind of services they provide. But ultimately, residents like Jacobo are at the mercy of the housing supply.
So even if the tiny home facility is amazing and great, it's hard for them to move into housing if there's no housing to move into.
San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan has come under fire for pushing to use money earmarked for permanent affordable housing to pay for tiny homes. but he credits them with reducing the number of people living on the streets by 10% from 2022 to 2023. The city's on track to more than double capacity, and Mahan wants others to follow their lead. He's co-sponsoring Senate Bill 1395 to free up state money for tiny homes and ensure projects are eligible for streamlined zoning.
I don't think that we should accept an approach that leaves thousands of people to live and die on the streets. So is it perfect? No. But it's a heck of a lot better than the status quo.
The bill passed out of the Senate last month with broad support. It's now in the Assembly. For the California Report, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
And that is the California Report for Tuesday, June 4th. We're a production of KQED Public.